Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley here with the one and only TV legend Carol Burnett, who's coming to Strathmore on July 25th and the Model Lyric in Baltimore on July 23rd, so two chances to see her. Hey, thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you.
There's so much I want to ask you about your career and the late Tim Conway, but let's start with Strathmore here. What's the setup here? Is it an audience interaction, video clips? Break it down for me.
Well, it's really a conversation with the audience, you know, the way I used to do open my show with doing Q&A, questions and answers. And there are no planned or pre-planned questions at all. It's just kind of random. I'm flying without a net, which really makes it more fun. And I start the show by showing about eight or nine minutes of some of my favorite Q&As from the show. So that gets the audience acquainted with how the evening is going to go. And then I come out and we bump up the lights and we have ushers with microphones who, and so when I call on somebody, if they raise their hand, I'll call on, and the ushers get a mic to them, and then they ask a question, and we're off and running.
Awesome. So they're not writing questions ahead of time. You're pulling them out of a hat or something. It's right there live in the theater.
Totally, yeah. And I've said this before, it keeps the old gray matter ticking. I can't be thinking about what I did yesterday or what I might do tomorrow. I've got to really be in the now. So it's a great exercise for the brain, and I just have a lot of fun doing it, and lots of times there are the same questions that I get. You know, it just depends on whom I call on, you know. But the most common questions are, why did you pull your ear at the end of the show? Do the Tarzan yell? How did that come about? Was Tim Conway as funny in real life as he was on the show?
Right.
How did I find Vicky and Harvey and things like that? And then, you know, then just other random questions. And I really enjoy it.
That's great. Well, I don't want you to have to run through all of those for the interview, but treat our listeners. Let's pick one of them. What's behind the ear tug?
Oh, that was 100 years ago when I got my first job on television. I called my grandmother, Nanny, who raised me, and I told her that I was going to be on TV, and I was in New York, and she was in California. And she said, well, say hello to me. I said, Nanny, I don't think they're going to let me say hi, Nanny, on television, but we cooked up this signal that I would pull my left ear. I would tug on my left ear, which meant, hi, Nanny, I love you, and I'm fine, and, you know, and then later on, as I got more successful, it meant, hi, Nanny, I'm fine, I love you, your check's on the way.
You know, but it's that iconic signature of yours, so I love that it's based on such a sweet story that you're giving a wink to Grandma.
Right, that's right. You know, she's long gone, but I still do it.
Well, I'd like to think she's still tugging her ear back at you.
I'd like to think that, too.
Speaking of which, you know, in one of your recent acceptance speeches, you mentioned that you grew up watching, like, 8 movies a week with her, and you recounting getting your first TV set. You know, take me back to those early days and how formative you think that was watching those shows with Nanny.
You know, we were poor, but we would save our pennies, and way back then, you know, in the 40s when I was growing up, 40s and 50s, the movies, they didn't cost that much. I think for my grandmother it was a quarter, and for me until I turned 12, it was a dime to go to the movies,
right.
And then they taxed it, and then it was 26 cents and 11 cents. You know? And so we were able to, and also at that time they would have double features, which were second run after they first ran in the big theaters.
Sure.
So you could go and see 2 movies for the price of one, and so on a weekend, you know, we might see 2 on Saturday and 2 on Sunday. So, and then sometimes on Wednesday nights there would be a kino night at one of the theaters, you know, where we would go. And so I would see as many as, you know, 4 to 6 to 8 movies a week.
What were some of them? Do you remember any that you loved as a kid?
Oh, I loved all the musicals. You know, Gene Kelly and Mickey and Judy and Betty Grable and Rita Hayworth and those movie stars. And what was really a kick for me was that when I got my show, I got to have some of those movie stars on as a guest. It was such a thrill. You know, I grew up loving Betty Grable, and she was a guest, and Rita Hayworth, Lana Turner, you know, Bing Crosby, Donald O'Connor, you know. But the thing is, Jason, when I was growing up, the movies were not cynical.
Right.
There was,
right.
You know, they were not cynical. They were all, the bad guys lost, the good guys won. There was no gray area.
There weren't these anti-heroes like now.
No. And so everything was like, it was an imprint on me, which I think kind of saved me in a way, was that you could do anything. If Mickey and Judy, you know, like Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney in the movie, put on a show in their barn, it was inevitable that it would wind up on Broadway. You know, that's the way the movies were. So when I went to New York, I didn't know anybody, and I'd never been in further east in Texas, where I was born. But I never felt that I couldn't make it. By that, I don't mean making it to be a star. I meant just that I wanted to be able to be in show business, perform, and be able to pay the rent and put food on the table and clothes on my back. That was my goal. And I was never scared. And I think it was because of those movies. I was too naive or too dumb to be to be scared. And I think that's what saved me. That helped me.
I love that you say that all those movies, you know, the optimism and the joy sort of shaped your outlook, how everything wasn't so cynical back then, and the fact that it actually saved you. Do you think you went into a career of comedy, like wanting to lift people up with your show? Like, do you think that took you in that direction?
I think so. At first, I was going to be a journalist, and I went to UCLA to major in journalism, but they didn't have a major in journalism. So I took the writing courses, and I joined the school paper. But then I was looking through the catalog, and they had a theater arts major, and subtext were theater arts film, theater arts acting, theater arts writing, theater arts English. And so I thought, oh, that's interesting, because I love to write. So I took theater arts English because it would offer me playwriting courses and things like that. But unknown to me until I got there was that even if you're you want to be a director or a scenery designer or whatever, as a freshman you had to take an acting course. Mm-hmm. That was the farthest thing from my mind. I was 18 and I had to take this acting course, and I was terrified. And there were about 14 of us in the class, and I had to get up and do a monologue, you know, and I was just terrible. but then later on, we had to do some other scenes, and I teamed up with a fellow classmate, and he and I did a scene from Noel Coward's Red Peppers, which was, I think it was a one act, and they sang, and so I just pretended to be Betty Grable with a Cockney accent, and they laughed where they should, you know, and the teacher gave us an A, and then I got in a couple of one acts at UCLA, and that went great, and all of a sudden, you know, I'm hearing people laugh, and it was just the greatest feeling, and I never knew that I was ever going to do that until I did it in college. And then another classmate who was in the music department asked me if I could carry a tune, and I said, oh, yeah, I think so, yeah, because my mother and grandmother and I used to sing in the kitchen, and Mama would play the ukulele, and we'd harmonize and everything. So I got into the music department, and they were doing a scene from South Pacific, and I was one of the nurses in the chorus, and I was so loud they took me out, and the director said, would you do a scene with me from Guys and Dolls and sing Adelaide's Lament, which was a very funny song in that show. And I was a little nervous about singing alone, but then I looked at the song, and in it, Miss Adelaide has a bad cold. And I thought, oh, I can do that, because if I hit a clam or it's not good, I can blame it on the fact that the character has a cold.
Right.
You know, so I did that, and that was, and then my love was musical comedy. And all of a sudden, boom, not being a journalist, and my whole life changed because there wasn't a major in journalism at UCLA.
Wow, yeah, I'm glad you did that switch. I think you did the right path there. I appreciate that. I love hearing those early roles of, you know, theater arts and all that stuff. But take us into, how did the Carol Burnett Show actually come about? Because you'd been on various CBS shows leading up to that, right? For almost like a decade, like Gary Moore, Paul Winchell, a bunch of shows. But you didn't want to do another sitcom. You wanted a variety show. And you know, at that point, there hadn't been a woman hosting a variety show. So how did you stand your ground and get that variety show?
Believe me, I didn't have to, because I had a very strange, odd, unusual contract with CBS that was signed. I signed with them after I left the Gary Moore Show for 10 years to do, each year I would do a guest shot on a sitcom and a special. But then there was a caveat, a clause in the contract. I had a very good agent, said that within the first 5 years of the 10 years, if I, Carol, wanted to push that button, CBS would have to put us on for 30 one-hour variety shows, comedy variety. And so I thought, well, I'll probably never do that, you know. But then towards the end of the fifth year, my husband and I had just moved to California, and we put a down payment on a house, and we said, you know what, maybe we better push that button. So I called, it was the last week of the fifth year, and I called the vice president in New York, and I said, I'm calling to push that button, and he'd totally forgotten. He had no idea what I was talking about. And this was the week between Christmas and New Year's. And he said, well, let me get back to you. You know, and I've said this before. I think they got a lot of lawyers out of Christmas parties that night, you know. And he called back the next day, and he said, well, yeah, I see that, Carol. But, you know, comedy variety is a man's game. And he said, it's Sid Caesar, it's Milton Berle, it's Jackie Gleason, it's Dean Martin now, and on and on. And he said, but we would love you to do, they had a sitcom they were talking to me about called Here's Agnes. I said, I don't want to be Agnes every week. I want to have different costumes. I want to be different characters. I want to have music. I want to have a rep company like Sid Caesar had. I want to have guest stars and dancers and all of that. And they had to put us on. So it wasn't that I held my, well, the only way I held my ground was to say, no, I'm not going to do Here's Agnes. But they had to put us on the air, and they didn't have any faith in us at all. And I wasn't too sure myself, but at least we said, well, we'll get 30 shows out of it that season. And then it took off. And in fact, at the end of the 11th season, they wanted us back for a 12th. But I felt that it was time to leave before I was asked to leave. You know, we were doing okay, but I think, you know, in 11 years we just started kind of repeating ourselves a little bit, and I thought, well, it's time to move on. And so we had 11 wonderful, joy-filled years, for which, I mean, I'm so grateful. And it's even today. I mean, you know, I get fan mail from 10-year-olds. Teenagers who watch us on YouTube or who have bought the DVDs or that we put out, and we're on MeTV and everything, and the mail I get, you know, from young people, and also the comments on YouTube are just, it's amazing.
Well, it's because funny is funny. You know, a 10-year-old can watch that and still laugh, and, you know, you are breaking up on set. That was always the funniest part.
I know. We never did it on purpose. Never.
Right.
Never. It was always, God bless him, Tim Conway's fault. He was out to get us.
He was the one that would always break you. Yeah. Well, I know we just lost him. You know, talk to me about Tim and what made him a genius there and cracked you all up so much on the show, and why you miss him so much.
Well, I miss him as a human being, too, because he was as nice as he was funny. That's a very kind, sweet soul. And but he, when he was in his comedy, he was fearless. And we would tape two shows on Friday. We would do the first show, and we would tape it with an audience. And Tim would do it exactly the way we'd rehearsed it all week. Then he would go to the director before the second show and ask, you know, how did it go in the first show? Did you get all the shots and everything's fine? So then, yeah, and so then he would do stuff on the second show that had never we'd never seen him do. And I would say 9 times out of 10, that's what we used because it was pure gold. And he would come up with stuff. The mind of his was just absolutely, in my view, genius. Things that you nobody would ever think anybody would do, he would do. he was just, that's who he was. And I've often said maybe there are people as funny as Tim, but I can't think of anybody who was more funny than Tim.
Right, absolutely. Well, we miss him. You know, everyone's heart broke when he passed because we all loved him. Of course, it's collaborative. It was you and Tim, but your other co-stars. Can you just, one at a time, you know, the first thing that comes to mind when I say Harvey Korman?
I think he was probably one of the most brilliant comedic actors we have had. There was nothing he couldn't do. He could imitate. I remember we would do a lot of movie takeoffs and everything. And one of my favorite ones was when he was Ronald Coleman in Random Harvest. We did a takeoff on that, and mm-hmm. he became Ronald Coleman. He was Clark Gable in our Gone with the Wind sketch.
Yeah.
It was like he was channeling, you know. And then there was no accent he couldn't do. There were times when we would do like a takeoff on an Italian family or whatever. I would do a generic Italian accent. He would do one that maybe was from southern Italy. You know?
Right.
It was just amazing what he could do. And he was, I often say, and I say this, you know, when I'm doing my show, my Q&A show, that Harvey... because he was so good, if you want to learn to play a good tennis game, you want to play with a better tennis player. It only
right.
makes your game better. And that's what Harvey did for me, for all of us. He made our game better because he was so good. And he was very sweet with Vicky because Vicky was 18 and had no really professional experience at all. We really took a chance on her. But I felt that there was something there, and I turned out to be right. But Harvey, like the first season, she was pretty shy and kind of awkward and scared and all. And he took her under his wing, and he taught her how to listen when you're in a sketch, not just wait for your cue to speak, how to deal with props. He even helped her with accents and things like that. And Vicky was like a sponge. She just, she ate it up and learned, as she says, she learned her craft in front of 30 million people every week for 11 years.
When did she and you all come up with the character of Mama? You know, how did that come up?
That happened when our two writers, Dick Clare and Jenna McMahon, came up with that, and I read it, and I said, this is really, it's brilliant. It's like little one-acts, and there were no jokes in it. It was all character-driven. And so at first, they wrote Mama for me, that I would play Mama, and we would have a guest star play Eunice. And I said, you know what? Eunice speaks to me. I think I could do Eunice better than I could do Mama. And then
right.
we were going to hire an older actress to play Mama. And Bob Mackey, our costume designer, because we didn't know we were ever going to do it more than once. And our costume designer, Bob Mackey, the brilliant Bob Mackey, said, well, look, let's just put Vicky in a fat suit and take her eyelashes off and, and put slap a gray wig on her and let her be Mama. We said, okay. Well, it just turned out to be the best idea ever. And here I am 16 years older than Vicky, and she's playing my Mama. Brilliantly, I have to. And she she really got into that character. And then I thought when I read it, I thought they were more Southern or Southwestern. And so I threw in the accent, you know, to talk like that, because my background is Texas and Arkansas.
Sure.
And Vicki picked up on it, and Harvey. And so when we did it in the first run-through, the writers were horrified, because that's not the way they saw it. You know, they were both from Chicago, and they said, you're going to alienate the entire South, you know. And they thought it was a very wrong choice to do, but it turned out to be right, and they later agreed. You know, that made it twice as funny by doing it with those accents.
Totally. So funny that it got its own spinoff.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you know, we've talked Tim, Harvey, Vicki. Tell me, what was so fun about working with Lyle?
Oh, well, this was an idea that Carl Reiner had when we were talking to him about when I'm going to start my variety show. He's a friend. He said, you ought to get a good-looking, hunky announcer that you can go gaga over, the way I used to do on Gary Moore's show. You know, if we had Robert Goulet on or Peter Lawford or something, they'd bring me out, Carol, who's this kind of man-hungry kook. And it was funny at the time. And so that's how we got a whole, you know, all these very good-looking guys came in to audition. And Lyle walked in. Of course, he was very, very handsome. But he also had a sense of humor in the audition. So he got the job. And after a while, you know, I stopped doing that, oh, my God, I'm in love with Lyle bit, you know, because I was a grown woman and I had children. You know?
Right.
So I said, I don't want to do that anymore with Lyle. So instead of just that, then we started putting him in sketches, and he turned out to be a very good sketch performer. So it was just an ideal situation. You know, we all got along. And that's very important. And even though my name was, you know, it was a Carol Burnett show, it was a true rep company. We supported each other. There were many times when I would support Tim in a sketch, or Harvey would support Vicki, or Vicki would support, you know, so it was a true, it was like summer stock, you know, and
right.
There would be sketches where Tim would be the star of the sketch, or Harvey, or me, or Vicki, you know, and I think that's what made it work, because nobody hogged the limelight. We wanted everybody to score a touchdown.
Well, you scored a lot of touchdowns. Some might say you ran up the scoreboard. You mentioned it briefly earlier, but I got to ask. It's like the iconic scene, you know, you gone with the wind, you know, grabbing that curtain rod. I know we're radio, but try to paint us a picture of, you know, where you were when you came up with that, ripping that curtain rod off, and how heavy it was on your shoulders coming down the stairs.
The thing was, the writers had written that I would run up the stairs and then come down with the draperies just hanging on me, you know, just kind of draped over my shoulder. And Bob Mackey, the genius that he is, said, that's not that funny. So when I went into costume fitting that week, I would always go on a Wednesday morning. He said, I have an idea for that curtain dress. And I said, what? And I went into the dressing room, and he had it there on that curtain rod, and I fell on the floor. I said, this is going to be one of the funniest sight gags in the history of television, and it was. And that was all Bob Mackey's idea. And in fact, he designed everything all of us wore for all 11 years, which amounted to an average of 65 costumes a week.
Wow.
And, and do the math, in 11 years, it amounts to a little over 17,000 costumes he designed. But, you know, everything all of us wore, and the wigs and the clothes, everything. And I'm so thrilled for him, because he recently won the Tony for costume design for the Cher show on Broadway.
Right, right. You're right. And speaking of awards, earlier this year, the Golden Globes, they basically invented a Life Achievement Award for you. It's one thing to get a Life Achievement Award, but to have one invented for you, you know, how touched were you by that?
It's one of the greatest. I mean, for me, what an honor, you know. They said they were going to create the category, because they didn't have one for Lifetime Achievement in Television, and they were going to create it for this year, and they were going to give it to me as the first recipient. And then they said, no, we're not only going to do that, but we're going to name it after you. And I was just totally gobsmacked. That was quite an honor.
Yeah, because they had a movie one named after Cecil B. DeMille, so, you know, now it's I'm ready for my close-up Miss Burnett.
That's right.
Awesome. Well, you've been more than generous with your time, and I'm sure you're a busy woman, but it's been a blast talking with you, and I've loved hearing all these stories. I'm honored.
Lovely talking to you too, Jason.
Thank you so much. I'm tugging my ear right now.
Oh, and me right back at you.